I hadn't been serving as a pastor of a local church very long, when one day I heard a phrase used by one of my new congregants that confused me. I was in the middle of a conversation with a small group of folks about an important theological matter, when one of the participants blurted out to another, "Well, I see your point, but I disagree, because I'm not an Old Testament Christian. I'm a New Testament Christian." I was confused by what the person meant, since I had just spent 3 years in a graduate school of theology, and I had never once heard those terms, Old and New Testament Christians, used. So I asked, "What exactly do you mean by that?" "Well, you know," the gentleman said, "the Old Testament is all about an angry God who wipes out nations and punishes people for not following the rules. I don't believe in that kind of God, an Old Testament God. No, I believe in a warm, loving God, like the one found in Jesus and in the New Testament. So that's why I call myself a New Testament Christian." Well, I could understand what the gentleman meant. For when we say Old Testament, or the Hebrew Scriptures, right away many think about stories like God wiping out the world through the flood. But what they fail to realize is that that's only a part of the story of God that's contained in the Old Testament. Folks who say that are skipping over huge chunks of the Old Testament that show a very different God. So that's why this morning, on this Baptism of the Lord Sunday, when I know that most of my colleagues out there will be reading the gospel lesson from the third chapter of Luke that tells a story of how John the Baptist baptized Jesus, that's why I chose to instead call our attention to the Old Testament passage, for it shows us that other side of God. In this morning's passage from the 43rd chapter of Isaiah, the prophet is speaking to a group of people who were entirely demoralized. They had first been warned by God to shape up and get their act together. They ignored those warnings, and then they'd been defeated and drug off into exile. So what was God's message for this unruly group of folks? "Neener, neener, neener," or "See, you got what you deserved," or "I'll show you for ignoring me." No, it was none of those things. It expressed words that God's people, at perhaps the lowest point of their lives, never expected to hear. Words that have lasted over thousands of years. Words that were used at the pivotal moment of Jesus' baptism, and words that were even used at our own. So listen carefully to these beautiful words from Isaiah chapter 43, verses 1 through 7. And then let's come back together and see what these words suggest about the kind of lives our baptisms call us to live. "But now, God's message, the God who made you in the first place, Jacob, the one who got you started, Israel, don't be afraid. I've redeemed you. I've called your name. You're mine. When you're in over your head, I'll be there with you. When you're in rough waters, you will not go down. When you're between a rock and a hard place, it won't be a dead end, because I am God, your personal God, the Holy of Israel, your Savior. I paid a huge price for you, all of Egypt, with rich Cush and Seba thrown in. That's how much you mean to me. That's how much I love you. I'd sell off the whole world to get you back, trade the creation just for you. So don't be afraid. I'm with you. I'll round up all your scattered children, pull them in from east and west. I'll send orders north and south. Send them back. Return my sons from distant lands, my daughters from faraway places. I want them back. Every last one who bears my name, every man, woman, and child whom I created for my glory. Yes, personally formed and made each one. Thus ends the reading. As I was working in the church office this week, I got a call from someone in the neighborhood asking about the possibility of having their child baptized here at WHCC. When I heard what the caller was interested in, I took a deep breath and then launched into my answer. And I took a deep breath because the answer to the caller's question is a lot more complicated than many realize. Let me tell you why I say that. You see, we in the United Church of Christ are a little different than some other Christian traditions. For there are some Christian traditions, for example, that believe baptism is absolutely necessary for salvation. They teach that if a person dies without having been baptized, then that person is condemned for eternity. In our tradition, however, the majority of us do not believe that. We believe that God's love and grace is far too big to be limited exclusively to a ritual, even if that ritual is a sacrament. So, if our tradition doesn't believe that baptism is a requirement, then that must mean we're all willy-nilly about it, right? That we run around baptizing everyone. No. Well, I guess I'm confused, Pastor Craig, some of you might be thinking. So which way is it? Is it so important that it's required and we have really high standards? Or, because it's not required, does that mean that it's meaningless and we'll baptize just old anyone? Well, let me see if I can clear up your confusion. And in order to do that, I want to use a bit of a movie. Now, I'm personally really bad at summarizing movie scenes. So I'm going to use this morning the summary that a colleague of mine, a colleague by the name of Greg Asimopoulos, wrote to help us better understand how we should see baptism. Greg writes, in Disney's animated movie, Toy Story, Woody, a plush toy cowboy, confronts Buzz Lightyear, a toy astronaut, with the fact that he is only an action figure and not really a space hero. Early in the movie, Woody shouts, "You're not a space ranger. You're an action figure, a child's plaything." Only after failing to fly, Buzz realizes the truth of Woody's statement. Grief-stricken and disillusioned, Buzz hangs his head in resignation, declaring, "Oh, I'm just a stupid, little, insignificant toy." Woody later feels bad and seeks to comfort his friend by underscoring the love of the boy who owns them both. "You must not be thinking clearly," Woody says. "Look, over in that house, there's a kid who thinks you're the greatest. And it's not because you're a space ranger. It's because you're his." As Buzz lifts his foot, he sees a label affixed to the bottom of his little shoe. And there, in permanent black ink, is the name of the little boy to whom he belongs. Seeing the image of his owner, Buzz breaks into a smile and takes on a new determination. And that, my friends, is what the essence of baptism is all about. Being marked by God. Letting the world know whose you really are. That illustration so beautifully helps us understand how God works in both the Old Testament and New. For if you think about it, at the time of the prophet's words in Isaiah, the people were in a spot much like Buzz Lightyear. Their defeat at the hands of the Babylonians and their subsequent exile must have made them feel as if they too were just stupid, little, insignificant toys. Have any of you here this morning ever felt that way? And at the moment when they were at their absolute lowest, came the best news of all. And no, that moment didn't involve finding any labels in the bottom of their shoes. It came in the form of the prophet's words, passed on from God. I paid a huge price for you. All of Egypt with rich Cush and Seba thrown in. That's how much you mean to me. That's how much I love you. I'd sell off the whole world to get you back and trade the creation just for you. Okay, Pastor Craig, I get it. The God of both Old and New Testament is a loving, gracious God, unlike any other. But what's that got to do with the matter of who you and we will baptize or not? Well, just this. Well, as I said earlier, we in the United Church of Christ tend to not believe that baptism is necessary for salvation. We do believe that baptism is the equivalent of putting a label on a proverbial shoes, as was the case with good old Buzz Lightyear. For our baptisms mark the individual for the rest of his or her life as belonging to God's. And friends, being marked as God's beloved is not something we take lightly. That marking means several things. It means a promise to live and to love together in Christian community, supporting each other daily with our gifts and our prayers. Our baptisms mean a life where our relationship is not just one of many things in our list of priorities, but rather our baptism signals a lifetime where our relationship with God is at the very top of the list. And friends, our baptism means also a life marked by not what we get from God, but a life defined by what we give to God as well. That is what baptism is all about, and that is why we take it so seriously. And so, as we begin a new calendar year, full of things that would, if they had their way, mark us as theirs, we are blessed this morning with a moment to remember just whose we are, to remind us of that, I'm going to do an ancient ritual designed to help us remember, a sprinkling of water. And as I walk up and down the aisles sprinkling the water, please, by all means, know this, that the water I use for the sprinkling has not been blessed or consecrated, and nor am I using any of the words traditionally associated with a baptism ceremony. That's because I don't want anyone here to mistakenly think that what I'm about to do is a group baptism. No, far from it. But rather, for those who have already been baptized, this moment is the equivalent of Buzz Lightyear's moment. A moment when you might finally get in the deepest sense not only what you are, but whose you are. And for those who've not yet been baptized, may the splash of the waters be a first hint of invitation to finding out for yourself the answer to those questions. Please remain seated in your pews and receive now this reminder.